This podcast is sponsored by Baxter Healthcare. Baxter's Starling Fluid Management Monitoring System provides continuous, accurate, non-invasive, and personalized hemodynamic monitoring to support individualized fluid management. The Starling system empowers you to make patient-specific fluid management decisions wherever your patient is in the hospital, helping to deliver the right therapy to your patient every time. Visit starling.baxter.com to learn more. This device is prescription-only use. For safe and proper use of the product mentioned herein, please refer to the appropriate operator's manual or instructions for use.
Hello and welcome to the 2024 Congress edition of the Society of Critical Care Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ludwig Lin. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Maurizio Ciccone, MD, to discuss this year's Max Harry Weill Honorary Lecture on the topic of fluid resuscitation. Professor Ciccone is an anesthesiologist and intensive care specialist and chair of the Department of Anesthesia and Intensive Care at Humanitas Research Hospital and University in Milan, Italy. Dr. Ciccone, welcome, and thank you so much for agreeing to do this podcast. Before we start, do you have any disclosures that we should report?
Hello, Ludwig, and great to be here to talk about this very interesting topic and a passion of my research for many years. The disclosure that I have, I've done research in collaboration with a series of hemodynamic monitoring companies. Probably the biggest conflict that I have is that I do believe that in complex patients, having data on advanced monitoring can provide useful information to treat our patients.
Great. Well, you know, there are so many different ways for us to approach a conversation about hemodynamics and monitoring and ways of altering that. So maybe what we can do is I'll just ask you about your philosophy in that we have a lot of data that we can get. We have more and more technology that we can use to obtain new types of data. There are things that we all talk about, vasopressors and fluids, to hopefully achieve a particular hemodynamic goal with the outcome of a positive one for our critically ill patient. So maybe what I can do is just get you to share with us your philosophy of how you approach this topic.
So it's a great question, probably also because if people read my research, they will see that a lot of the research is on advanced monitoring and how to give fluids and how we look at the response to fluids with our patients. But the reality, at the end of the day, I'm a bit advocate of a clinical judgment and the clinical examinations, first of all. And you can do a lot with that. My students and my trainees, sometimes they make fun of me saying that I ask them to touch the temperature of the patient or to do a capillary refill time, even on mannequins in the simulation center. But that's something that I really believe is important. Always not to forget that the diagnosis of hemodynamic instability, diagnosis of a patient in shock, is not something that you have to do with a monitor or with technology, something that you can really do with your clinical examinations. And most of the time, just with your hands, your eyesight, and by really examining the patient that you have in front of you. It does not mean that we don't need technology. It means that when we have diagnosed that the patient needs some attention and some treatment, and we talk about fluids today, and fluids are, of course, one of the cornerstones to stabilize the patient with hemodynamic instability or shock, then there are some situations where you want maybe to use technology to get some extra information because our clinical examination may be blind to what happens to blood flow. But again, when we have done a therapy, whether this is a fluid challenge or we started a vasopressor or a combination of both, this technology is helping me to guide the treatment, but at the end of the day, I always want to go back to the clinical examination and to the assessment of the adequacy of perfusion in my patient, which again, we don't do with this technology that we use to monitor, but the monitor is very useful to try to give the right amount of fluids without giving too much, without giving too little.
I love that. I feel like really, really good critical care medicine is really just being a good intern. You have to really pay attention to all the details. And also not to be too proud. I don't know if you know what I mean, but I think we all have our suspicions of what some patient might have. Going down one road immediately sometimes precludes us from exploring the other possibilities on the differential diagnosis. So you really have to have both. You really have to have the physical exam and then look for data, whether it's technology or lab data or whatever, to really corroborate and confirm that diagnosis. Do you know what I'm saying, sort of?
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. And in a way, it is being one of the reasons why with my research groups, first in the UK and now in Italy, we really try to study as much as possible something that seems so simple to say, like a fluid challenge. But, you know, we all have our own biases. We all have our own ways to define what a fluid challenge is or should be. And so there is still really a lot of research that we have to do to understand how we can really talk to each other with different colleagues, different clinicians, and really try to find maybe a common way to understand how fluids work and how we decide the therapy together at the bedside.
Let's talk about fluid challenges more. When you're thinking about fluid challenges, are there particular subtypes of patients in shock that you were thinking about? Or is that something that's applicable to all types of shock?
That's a great question. And to be fair, I think there is still a bit of confusion there. You know, FENICE was one of the largest observational studies. It was Fluid Challenges in Intensive Care. The acronym stands for that. And we conducted a study with Daniel De Backer and others with the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine about 10 years ago now. And we were finding some very interesting findings there. For instance, the variability of what people call a fluid challenge is huge. You go from 500 mL, which is the average. And I suspect this is very pragmatic average just because there are the 500 mL bags that are easier to open and to give to patients. Everything was going from 200 mL to a liter. The speed, so the rate of administration was going from 250 mL an hour to 1 liter per hour, or maybe a bit more. And I suspect, again, that's not a lot of thinking there, probably just what is the maximum speed of your pump at the bedside. So lots of those things, they prompted us to look at this issue as an opportunity to do research and maybe to do some quality improvement at the bedside. So back to your question, what is a fluid challenge? A fluid challenge, in my view, should not be confused with fluid administration. It is part of fluid administration, but when you decide to give a fluid challenge, and I'm sure we will discuss a bit today about when we can predict whether the patient will respond or not to fluids. But when you have decided that fluid administration could be an option for this patient, I don't think it matters too much if this patient is in cardiogenic shock or septic shock. As long as it has decided that fluids could be an option, I think when you want to test that hypothesis, so why don't you take that opportunity to do it in a controlled way? And so this is what I call a fluid challenge, which probably we can summarize as a definition as a small bolus of fluid that is useful to do therapy, but at the same time to inform about the physiological response and the physiological status of the patient in response to the fluid that I'm giving.
I like it. So for you, is there like a starting volume that you think about?
Another great question. We have done a series of papers in this, and if I go back for a moment, let's talk about what are the components of a fluid challenge. And I think about the type of fluids that, you know, we're giving. For simplicity today, I think we should just focus on crystalloids and not dwell too much into others, especially because if we give fluids in a short period of time, we can kind of assume that during that short period of time, there is not really a lot of redistribution outside of the intravascular space, but maybe we can discuss about these nuances as well. There is the volume of fluid, and the volume of fluid, you can think about the fixed volume, you can think about volume per kilograms of our patients. And then when I give the fluids, of course, there is the time in which I'm giving these fluids. To give it in 5 minutes, in 10 minutes, or in 20 minutes, you may be surprised or not. You can find very different answers. And the threshold that defines my response. Who is a patient that is a responder? Is a patient that increases the cardiac output and the stroke volume by 10%, by 15%? You understand why we talk to each other. There are so many variables here that actually, you know, the same clinical problem can be tackled probably in slightly different ways. But it's important to think about these things. At the bedside, I think particularly within your team, so within your ICU, probably you should have a way to try to have a standard approach to this test when you give it in your patient. I'm not sure we have found the perfect recipe yet. Maybe there isn't a perfect recipe yet. The type of patients, of course, matters. If my patient is very vasodilated, maybe I will need to give a bit of more volume to increase the stress volumes according to the Guytonian theories and therefore to increase the mean systemic filling pressures and the gradient for the venous return. Maybe in a surgical patient with, you know, vascular tone that is intact, we can give a bit less fluids. But again, the overall message is that it does not matter so much if the shock is due to one reason or the other. You can still use this technique. The important thing is that, of course, you think about the patient in front of your eyes, and, you know, that may change a little bit what you do. But I still like to use this approach in the moment that I've decided that I want to give fluids to this patient because I'm thinking that fluids may improve the clinical situation of this patient. To test this hypothesis, yes, I usually do it with a small bolus of fluid and I see what happened to the initial response and whether this response is sustained or not and so on.
I see. I think to summarize what you're saying is the idea of a fluid challenge is the most important concept, really, when you're by the bedside. think about doing it. And then one and one's team need to reach some consensus about what the definition of the response would be to that fluid challenge. And maybe one can actually tailor the volume involved and the speed involved depending on the patient's comorbidities or the disease process that's happening. Is that about right?
Yes. And let's make a practical example with some of my research, with some of my groups. I remember when I was in London, we started to look at pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of fluid administration, exactly because we saw that there was so much variability in what people were defining as a fluid challenge around the world. And we thought, let's go back to basic. We give a small bolus. We looked at the total response in terms of increases in cardiac output. And we wanted to see when there was the maximum response. Was it immediately after the end of the fluid challenge? Was it a bit later? We looked at this maximum response, and then we followed this for a few minutes to see how long this effect was sustained. And when we did that, we found out that, for instance, even in surgical patients, which in theory they should have kind of a tone that is still intact, responders and non-responders, they were separated by the degree of increase in cardiac output. That's easy to understand. But then both responders and non-responders in that study, we found that actually after 10 minutes, they had completely dissipated the effect of that fluid challenge. So why is this important? Because I should give fluids, first of all, when I think that there is a clinical problem. So can I improve the perfusion of my patient? If I can predict even before giving fluids, whether this patient will have an increase in cardiac output or not, by giving this fluid, probably I should use these techniques. And whether this is pulse pressure variation, stroke volume variation, passively grazing, there are many of those. Nevertheless, there comes a moment where you, with all the information that you have for our patients, with the seriousness of the situation at the time, you know, whether I'm treating this patient in A&E or 2 days later in intensive care, that also changes a bit. When I have all this information and I decide, yes, I think fluids could be an option here to improve this situation, then yes, I think with my team, I like to have a kind of a standard approach on how I give this fluid. Because we are taking care of patients 24/7. A patient now may be different at 10 o'clock at night. And actually exchanging this information between teams is very important. And it's also very important that you find a way in which you trust the test, both when it's positive, but also when it's negative. If you don't trust the test, if you don't trust the test that your colleague has made, you run the risk that then to bring your conscious or unconscious bias, and you were talking about being proud before. And so we run the risk maybe to just follow our initial idea without right. being informed by the physiological response of what we see in front of our eyes.
Right. So let's talk about that. I think it's nice when talking with colleagues to have a common language. And I think in medicine, that common language winds up being about data. So are there ways of using monitors or using data to gauge the responsiveness? And which, if yes, what are the ones that you like?
So, yes, there are ways, and I think we have a lot of technology and monitors at the bedside, and not necessarily always we need to have very advanced monitors. So, a standard blood pressure monitor and a heart rate monitor in a patient that responds to fluids is already giving us a lot of information. And so I think the important thing is to realize that when you're doing a test like this, exactly because you're testing the system, you need to put yourself almost into an experimental condition. So in this moment, I like my patient to be calm and not to have any maneuvers, no aspirations, no changes in bed positioning. So everything needs to stay, you know, as still as possible. I give my fluids, and when I give my fluids, I want to see how the heart rate is changing, how the blood pressure is changing. If I see that the heart rate comes down and the blood pressure goes up, I don't need a fancy cardiac output monitor to tell me that the patient had responded to fluids with an increase in cardiac output. I'm seeing the proxy of that with the increase in blood pressure, with the decrease in heart rate. The problem that we have is when, despite giving our fluids and our therapies, because these concepts apply to many things that we do in intensive care, we don't see any response. And when we don't see any response with basic monitoring, if my patient is not improving clinically, and as I was telling to you before, I always like to go back every time I do a treatment to a quick examination of my patient, then in that situation, if the patient is not improving, maybe it's getting worse, and the standard monitors that I have are not informing me, they're not showing me a response, then there are two possibilities of this lack of response. One, that there is really no response, and therefore fluids are not indicated. Or one that simply that I'm not seeing the response with an increase of blood flow because the changes in blood pressure or the lack of changes in blood pressure, actually, they are masking this effect. So that goes back to the clinical judgment. So if my patient is sick and is not improving, and I don't see any changes in the variables, maybe in that situation, yes, that's where I want to very quickly put an echo probe if I've not done it yet. Look at the cardiac function, make an assessment. I like to combine also technology. I'm not someone that would say you should always use echo or you should always use cardiac output monitor. I think we're moving away from that. We need to have a more holistic approach to more variables to try to get as much information as possible, especially in very sick patients, in which variable time is a very important variable. So we want to get this information in this moment, because to have this extra information then can inform us whether to proceed with fluids or actually do something else.
So this is a personally driven question, I guess, because when I was a medical student, I worked on this one variable. It was gastric intramucosal pH. Mm-hmm. And I feel like throughout the history of medicine, there's been these hopes that there is some holy grail, you know, variable that would tell us if somebody is adequately perfusing or not. Do you have such?
So that's a great example, because actually the gastric tonometry was probably one of the most promising technology at some point, even with some very positive data, you know, from little trials and improvement in outcomes. But we abandoned it because it was not feasible to use it practically at the bedside. One other very important thing is that we need to look at the variability on how we give fluids, but also to find technology that is feasible to use. If something is very interesting and maybe very useful, but it's impossible to bring at the bedside because of how cumbersome it is and because it's impossible to make sure that 24/7 you're someone able to use this, maybe that's not the right technology. But I like your example very much, because using technology to inform us about what happened in terms of responses to fluids in cardiac output is one thing. But the most important thing is going back again to clinical examination. And when I mention clinical examination, I actually mention the adequacy of perfusion. And again, a clinical examination is one part of it, but it's not enough, especially in very sick patients. So in very sick patients, I still like to measure a venous blood gas if I have a central line. And I like to see how the central venous saturation is. We had a trial that showed that if you're using multicentric randomized approaches, it didn't show an improvement in mortality. Well, those studies, they don't remove the physiological sense, in my opinion, that if a patient has a low SCVO2, which is very rare now, well, that's a very useful information to have in that patient. You shouldn't throw that information away if you have it. So to use adjuncts to our clinical examinations that are informing us about the adequacy of perfusion, I think it's very, very important. And I do think that we are living in an era that will be a revolution in how we practice medicine. AI was a kind of science fiction 10 years ago or up to 5 years ago, but now we start to see more and more the availability in many settings to predict what's happening, maybe to bring more variables together. One of my hope is that actually we will do exactly that. How can we look at the response, not just in terms of cardiac output response, but, you know, look at all the changes that we see, look at how the perfusion is changing, maybe in real time on a short period of time, and trying to put all these things together to understand when to start and when to stop.
Interesting. I want to follow up on that, because I feel like you've touched on the two ends of the forefront of critical care, which is on the one hand, using big data and using rigorous studies to guide our efforts. But on the other, it's about that one patient. And sometimes it's that very rare esoteric patient who might fall outside what, you know, a clinical trial shows we should do for most people, because that one patient is not most people. So how do you think we could use AI and big data to help that one rare patient?
That's another great question. And in a way, in your question, we already have the answer, in the sense that there are huge limitations in going just for physiology, because physiology may miss the picture of the important outcomes at the end of ICU stay or, you know, of hospital survival and so on. But at the same time, trials in intensive care, they're very difficult to do. We mixed very heterogeneous patients together for a treatment that then is the same. And then very often we don't find anything. About 8 to 9 times out of 10, our studies are negative. I like to do both trials and the physiological studies, but I like to do both because I think they're informing us about a new way to do research. And everyone talks now about phenotypes, and now we can stratify better probably within the group of patients, those patients that maybe would benefit from this approach and others that would not benefit from this approach. When I refer to this with these developments, I like to say it is when big data meets big trials. So probably we still need big numbers. I still think we need to randomize, but rather than randomizing very heterogeneous populations, probably what we will do is stratifying very similar group of patients in terms of possible responses to our treatment. This is an example for hemodynamics in our chat today, but this can apply to anything in medicine and in critical care. And so when big data meets big trials, we will have smaller trials for very homogeneous group of patients here, where probably we can test our hypotheses, still with a randomization, which I think is important to correct even for factors that maybe you're not seeing or you don't measure, and then we will really progress. You know, the pandemic has shown us that we can do big studies together. Of course, that was an advantage, if we may say, of having a single disease. But we have to find this approach in which we put a lot of data together, in which maybe we randomize patients, but we find that specific phenotype in which my hypothesis really makes sense. If I mix patients that are so different, I'm diluting maybe an effect, and maybe I will then prevent in the future a therapy, which maybe was very useful for this group of patients and maybe causing harm in another one.
Right. I like that. It's like one size does not fit all, but we could find maybe multiple patterns that could explain, you know, the three or four different subtypes.
Yeah.
And that would be very useful.
Yeah. So I think it's exciting time for research and for our clinical practice and our specialty. And yeah, I think we have to watch this space because I'm sure that the speed of changing how we do research is changing very fast.
Let me try to go on a tangent here and ask you a little bit about the future of this, because I know that you yourself are very aware and advocating for the sustainability of critical care as a science. Some of this is expensive. Some of this is the purview of very developed and financially able countries. How do we provide care to the rest of the globe where, for example, personalized medicine is not possible, and really sort of strive for equity? How do you feel about that?
I feel that it's very important that especially us, that we have the privilege to work in places, and some of us even to positions in scientific societies where we can advocate for some of these changes and for equity. I really think it's important that we do that, first of all, and we advocate for this. The fact that we cannot do something in low and middle income country setting does not mean that we should not carry on progressing our knowledge with more advanced technology in our setting. But at the same time, a lot of these topics about fluids, for instance, they really apply with basic monitoring. I do think that in the majority of patients, you don't need an advanced monitor. You just need this approach that, you know, we discussed before, clinical examination, and that you can do everywhere. Trying to give fluids and again informing if this has caused an improvement or a deterioration in the clinical situation of our patient. That you can do many places. And for that, probably the most important technology is education and sharing knowledge. And I think bringing and exchanging knowledge with our colleagues that are maybe working in other parts of the world. But if we look at history, technologies always evolved and help us to be better as a society and to stay better, you know, to have better outcomes. So I don't think it's far away the moment where maybe we will have applications on our mobile phones that we can have now also in low and middle income countries, and maybe offer a way through a mobile phone to get some of the advanced data that in the past you were getting only with invasive monitors and so on. So everything is really changing very fast, but I agree with you, we should advocate for the progress also to proceed in less privileged parts of the world. And recent history has shown that we've not been very good with that. If you look at the pandemic and COVID and vaccinations, I don't think that was good enough, what we've seen there. In this moment, I think we have the responsibility to bring some of the progress to help our colleagues in more difficult settings to do research, to get the knowledge, and again, to get patients better also there.
Well, I really like your point that a lot of the goals in hemodynamic manipulation is actually just in the physiology. It's not about the technology. The technology could be very simple. And we do need to remember that. And that education, that knowledge is power, that empowering all of us with the ability to analyze these complex hemodynamic situations, that's really what's going to help. So I think that's a really good concept.
I like to think that's the way, and
yeah,
but I know that I'm biased because I absolutely love physiology, but I think if you come and work in intensive care, you must love physiology.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
I think that even in the future, in the near future, we will need more technology because we will have less healthcare workers comparing the proportion of patients that will require intensive care and healthcare. So technology is going to help us. We need that technology. But the understanding of physiology and the understanding of the mechanism, it's something that we need to keep, we need to preserve, and we need to make sure that the younger generation does not lose this drive to understand this physiology and then to use technology to be informed about it and to treat better our patients.
Great. I have a random question for you. Well, it's not that random. It doesn't really follow this train of thought. But fluid responsiveness, is that characteristic of a patient? Do you see that as a predictor of survival, or is it a treatable parameter that alters somebody's outcome?
So I would challenge the concept that is a characteristic of that patient. I would say is a characteristic of the physiology of that patient in that specific moment. So you and I, we can be fluid responsive now, non-responsive in 15 minutes and vice versa. And this is normal that is going to change. So that's why we need to look at physiological changes within the same patient when we talk about these concepts. But when we discussed, I think, and study fluid responsiveness, which, if we want to give a definition so far, is the response in terms of an increasing cardiac output or stroke volume when I give fluids to a patient, I think maybe we have made it a little bit oversimplistic. In the sense, to me, the response to fluids cannot be looked at just in terms of response in cardiac output. The response to me is if my patient gets better. So we need to start to bring more nuances to this concept, I think. And for that, again, we probably need to review a little bit what we're doing. Of course, at the end of the day, we need to look at the literature that we have. And the literature that we have is still very much focusing on this response to a cardiac output increase of 10 to 15%. But as we were discussing just a few minutes ago, there are so many different ways in which I can give fluid. And for instance, in one of the studies that we did, we randomized patients to receive from 1, 2, 3, or 4 milliliters per kilogram. Same baseline characteristics. We kept the infusion time at 10 minutes. And what you found, probably not surprising, was that if you randomized patient to just 1 milliliter per kilogram, only a small proportion of that patient had an increase in cardiac output. The ones that had 4 milliliters per kilogram had a much higher proportion. But if you think about it, you would have got very different responses to the same clinical question for that patient. And that's why I think we still have some research to do, really, to try to understand how to test the response in one patient in that specific moment. And also, if I may, sometimes we confuse fluid responsiveness with the prediction of fluid responsiveness. So fluid responsiveness is my response to fluids. The prediction of fluid responsiveness is the concept in which I can predict if there will be an increase in cardiac output even before giving fluids. And again, we have many tests now, and we should use these tests because if I think that my patient may improve with an increase in cardiac output thanks to fluids, and if I can predict before giving these fluids whether this is going to cure or not, I may spare unnecessary fluids to my patients. So this is important, but today I don't think we have the time to talk about all of this. There are so many other things that we don't consider normally when we talk about this. We focus sometimes too much on 200 mL giving in this moment, when maybe we are giving 100 mL an hour as a background infusion to these patients. And of course, that is also building up as positive fluid balance at the end of the day. So again, all this variability is a huge opportunity for improvement and for research. And I would be happy to work with many groups to try to find more answers to all these questions.
Oh, that is such a good point that we really have to be conscious of every single detail. I like that. There is so much more to talk about in terms of this, Maurizio, and I really wish we could spend more time, but we do need to actually wrap up the podcast. So let me ask you if there was anything that we didn't cover that you really wanted to make sure that the audience will take away from this conversation.
No, I think we talked about a lot of points. Maybe just one point that we didn't touch upon is the concept that probably you can test a response to fluid, or you can, you know, get a response in volume even without giving volume from the outside. And let me just be very specific and clear about this. So the interaction between fluids and vasopressors, I think it's another very important topic. I come from the generation where I was told that if a patient is hypotensive or in shock, first you give fluids, maybe a liter, maybe 30 milliliters per kilogram, and then you start a vasopressor if there has been no response there. I don't think that's very physiological. I think if you are very vasodilated and therefore you had a redistribution of fluids from the stress volume in the unstressed volume, we can give fluids in that situation, but probably it's a physiological approach also to try to restore some vascular tone and to recruit some unstressed volume into the stress volume. So I think a combination of vasopressors and fluids is something that, to gain time, something that probably we should consider now more and more in our practice. But I have to say that speaking with colleagues and seeing data, this is becoming more and more practice on this. And then just some very pragmatic messages maybe is that remember that fluids are drugs. We are not used to think about this sometimes in intensive care. Everyone gets a drip with some fluids. Everyone gets at least a face mask, but both fluids and oxygen are drugs. And as for any drugs, I think there are some positive effects you're seeking for, but there are also some side effects. So always think, does my patient have a problem? First of all, is there a problem with the perfusion of this patient? Do I think that increasing cardiac output will improve the perfusion? Do I think that fluids may be useful to increase the cardiac output? When I answer these three questions, then probably I can start to go then to, can I predict if my patient will respond to fluids or not? And then if I decide to give fluids again, try to do it in a controlled way. Try to do it with a small bolus of fluids. You can repeat this. So a small bolus of fluids, 4 meters per kilogram in 10 minutes, most of the time, this is sufficient to see a response or not. And look at the initial response, but also look if the response is sustained or not. If this is immediately dissipated, is that because you are thinking of some capillary leak, or is it just because we are distributing these fluids? And again, as I just said that just a few minutes ago, consider the combination of fluids and vasopressors together, and also that no matter what technology we are going to use to be informed more about what's happening or what can happen to our patients, is the clinical judgment, is the clinical examination with the adjunct or probably of a blood gas to see adequacy of perfusion. That's what leads the way in therapy and in our diagnosis and in our treatment.
That is a perfect way to summarize what we just talked about. So thank you. That was beautiful. And I really enjoyed this conversation. I think it's very thought-provoking, and hopefully the audience will feel the same. So thank you, Dr. Ciccone, for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And this is going to conclude another episode of the Society of Critical Care Medicine podcast series. Please do like and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. This is Dr. Ludwig Lin. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by Baxter Healthcare. Baxter's Starling Fluid Management Monitoring System provides continuous, accurate, non-invasive, and personalized hemodynamic monitoring to support individualized fluid management. The Starling system empowers you to make patient-specific fluid management decisions wherever your patient is in the hospital, helping to deliver the right therapy to your patient every time. Visit starling.baxter.com to learn more. This device is prescription-only use. For safe and proper use of the product mentioned herein, please refer to the appropriate operator's manual or instructions for use. Ludwig H. Lin, MD, is an intensivist and anesthesiologist at Sutter Hospitals in the Bay Area of Northern California, and is a consulting professor at Stanford University School of Medicine, where he teaches a seminar on the psychosocial and economic ramifications of critical illness. Join or renew your membership with SCCM, the only multi-professional society dedicated exclusively to the advancement of critical care. Contact a customer service representative at 847-827-6888 or visit sccm.org/membership for more information. The SCCM podcast is the copyrighted material of the Society of Critical Care Medicine, and all rights are reserved. Find more episodes at sccm.org/podcast. This podcast is for educational purposes only. The material presented is intended to represent an approach, view, statement, or opinion of the presenter that may be helpful to others. The views and opinions expressed herein are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or views of SCCM. SCCM does not recommend or endorse any specific test, physician, product, procedure, opinion, or other information that may be mentioned.